So we're on the eighth picture. And for those of you who are new, if you go to the Seattle Insight webpage and go under classes, and there's a talk series, all of these will come up. And you can not only see all of the pictures, but then you could go to the talks, and you can listen to the talks from Sunday morning, Monday night, and I think Thursday night as well. Plus some talks on the Oxherding pictures from some years ago by our founding teacher, Rodney. So there's a lot of ways of gaining some understanding if you're new to this. Forget both self and ox. This is our second week talking on this. Arv started at the first week, and then last weekend we didn't meet because of the non-residential retreat, which I hope some of you were able to join. I'm going to stop the sharing of that. And so as Jerry introduced me, I'm Sue Zappel, one of the local Dharma leaders, and I was on retreat during the first week, and I listened to Arv's talk and the discussion from that morning, and he reminded us of the different sections of these 10 pictures, and this picture number 8, Forget Both Self and Ox, is from the letting go section, which comes after the first section of searching and the next one of struggle. So by the time we've reached this eighth picture, we've worked pretty hard and we're more peaceful and our practice has deepened. And as we've discussed in the past weeks, the pictures 1 through 7 are what I would call kind of down to earth, you know, being lost, finding a path, working really hard, finding moments of calm and peace. And then last month, you know, kind of going back to one's own hut to reflect. And now we're at picture 8, and most commentaries describe it as one of emptiness. Not an easy concept to grok and understand. And I've had my own challenges with understanding that. Throughout this year, several of us have mentioned the teachings of Martine Batchelor and how helpful they've been, especially about these ox-herding pictures. She's a teacher in Europe and was a nun in Korea for many years. So as I was preparing for this morning, I listened to a recent talk of hers that she gave at Gaia House in England in March of this year. And as she was describing this eighth picture, she said, like other commentaries, that this picture is about emptiness. And then she went on in her talk and said that she likes to take the noun of emptiness and turn it into a verb, emptying. Oh my goodness, that really helped me. So this morning I'm going to talk mostly about emptying, and which I think is really what this eighth picture is addressing. And I'm going to cover 4 aspects: selfing, expectations, habits, and patterns, and then what comes next after we've done some emptying. So again, Martine Batchelor says that this process in this pictures 1 through 8 may be described as moving from 90% self-centeredness to only 50% self-centeredness. But that's a lot of emptying. And then it made me think about self-centeredness and what that is. It's like, you know, making things all about me and mine. All the ways we take shape in certain identities and then hold on to them for dear life. You know, believing that this me is solid and continuous and substantial, when in truth, this me is just a collection or an aggregate of conditions and patterns which are ever changing, even when it might feel like those conditions and patterns are permanent and solid. So I was on retreat 2 weeks ago with Tim and Narayan at Cloud Mountain. Jerry and Lauren were also at that retreat, which was lovely. And I spent quite a bit of time there looking at this concept of self-centeredness. mostly through the ways that the identities, that this me, takes shape. I shared with Tim in my first interview that I came to retreat with a friendship in mind that was in a hard place, a really important friendship to me. And I could see ways that I was taking shape as one who knows what's right for me and this other person, has the right idea of what will fix whatever problem is present. And that's a lot of big identities of knower and fixer. So Tim suggested in my interview that I gather a rock and put an identity into it and then practice with it, really spend time and energy to understand it, and then let the rock go. Well, as you can imagine, I had then on retreat, and I have now, way more than just the two identities of knower and fixer. So in the end, I created this like rock garden at Cloud Mountain. I kept on picking up rocks, which I called my identity dukkha rocks, and they formed quite a little pile when the retreat was over. I spent many walking sessions experiencing the shapes and identities I took on, you know, the big ones, knowing what's what, being the fixer, being the judge, the boss, the organizer. There were some old identities of being a needy little girl or feeling invisible as a child. And then a more recent identity of the aging woman. There are more, of course, but these started out as kind of my biggies. One of the rocks that I picked up smelled like earth, and it seemed like something I should hold on to. So I named that one Vision, and I actually brought that one home with me thinking that maybe it'll provide me some great vision. But the identity, this new one, or newer one of aging woman, the reality of aging and death, is real present in my life these days. And looking at these identities that take shape has become really important. Will I still be boss and landlord, or as my neighbor describes me, as the queen of Pellington Village? That's the name of my business. When I'm even older and undoubtedly more diminished? Or will I be able to relax and be at ease with someone else making the decisions about my property and business? Do these identities that we take on take shape as kind of the whole of us? What happens when I let go of, you know, even just 40% or 50% of them? We all take shape in so many different identities. And I think this picture 8 is an invitation to look at them, those that we embrace, embody, and hold on to. And I recognize that some identities can actually be useful to us, especially when we're involved in efforts of social, racial, or economic justice. Knowing who we are in these efforts can be a really important part of figuring out the next steps to take. However, most of the time, holding on so dearly to our various identities actually prevents us from experiencing the freedom of the, as the Buddha describes, the Four Noble Truths. Perhaps identifying some of them, putting them, that identity energy into a rock or practicing with it may be helpful for you all. I know it was really helpful for me. Let it go fully if you're able to, and maybe only 40 or 50%. That sounds like a good practice as well. Another aspect of this emptying after identities has to do with expectations. Certainly, we're all familiar with expectations about how things ought to be in our lives and how this moment ought to be. But also, we have expectations about our practice itself, expectations about how we receive the Dharma, how we listen to it. Many of us have heard this quote from that's attributed to the third Chinese patriarch of Zen. The path is not difficult for those who have no preferences. This eighth picture isn't the last one, and it won't necessarily be eliminating all of our preferences. But what if we shoot for a 40 or 50% reduction? Looking at preferences, let's start with preferences about how our practice should be. As I mentioned, I just came back from retreat, and for years, the 6:15 a.m. retreat or sit has always been my favorite. There's the early morning light and the soft energy and quietness of all the yogis as we enter the hall, the quietness of the morning and the yogis, all that combination. And I noticed so looking forward to those sits. And then, as life will sometimes be, my sleep was horrible on the retreat. I some mornings or nights only got a couple hours. So I'd get up early and do my, you know, have coffee and do some of my morning breath work and movement work before going into the meditation hall. And then I'd sit and I'd have this first feeling of, ah. And then I'd promptly fall asleep. So much disappointment. It's made so much worse by my expectation of this great early morning sit. So I had my strategies of standing, sitting with my eyes open, you know, all the strategies for how to deal with sloth and torpor. But I found that the main thing was that I was just sunk in disappointment. That this is not the way my early morning sit should be. And then years ago, I remember when I moved from sitting on a zafu to sitting in a chair. And I had associated sitting on a zafu with like real meditation. And that sitting on a chair was less than. You know, over those first months in the chair, as I looked at my beliefs about that, the belief that one posture was preferable over another, that one posture would lead me more quickly or even more assuredly toward freedom than another. So I've shared these stories about me to ask whether any of you have some of these kinds of expectations about your practice. Are you caught in the thinking that if I do this meditation strategy, then that will happen? Stillness, insight, collectedness of mind, whatever your expectation is. Now, for most of us, we've had a very habitual way of starting our sit. And I like to ask all of us to ask the question of how tied am I to that way? What happens when that way doesn't kind of work out very well or something else arises, like me and my 6:15 morning sit? The path is not difficult for those who have no preferences. Another way that expectations affect our practice is in our preferences for teachers and how the Dharma is offered. On the retreat, Narayan shared this really lovely story about a conversation she had with one of her early teachers. And she asked him, she said, it was an interview about awakening, and she said, shouldn't there be like trumpets playing or fireworks going off or something really dramatic? And it made me think about some of the expectations that I bring to Dharma talks, that I want them to have pizzazz and humor and, you know, quotes that I can then remember and really fabulous delivery techniques. And you know, of course we have our preferences, but when we put too great a stock in them, it may prevent us from really receiving the Dhamma that's being offered. Similar to expectations, there's that letting go or emptying out of all the habits and patterns that are unskillful that we hold on to. Perhaps it's the way we are in relationships, how we approach friendships, how we approach difficult or challenging tasks or situations, how we deal with conflict, even our general attitude as we wake up each morning. Yesterday, a number of us from Sims were at the Clear Mountain Monastery sit with Ta-Nehisi Bo, and he strongly suggested that we wake up each morning and develop a skillful habit, perhaps some bowing, perhaps some moments of metta, that we set a wholesome attitude that carries us for the entire day. For me, for a long time, the very first thoughts that appear when I wake up in the morning are thoughts of gratitude. And I kind of walk through all the different ways that I'm grateful for my life. How do you start your day? How we practice our usual ways, of course, you know, retaining those that are skillful and help us move towards the end of suffering. But do some of our habits just lead us to more suffering? Do we hold on to them because they're just familiar and comfortable? Because we believe, oh, I know how to do this. This is the way I've always done this. But what would happen if you mixed it up? When hindrances arise, for instance, do we have a habitual way of understanding them and addressing them? So for me, as you know, I had this big hindrance of sloth and torpor in my retreat. And I approached it and looked at it mostly through the lens of impermanence. You know, things used to be more this way and now they're that way and things change and don't hold on to the way things have been, kind of that kind of thinking. And when I went into my interview with Narayan, she challenged me, as these wonderful teachers do, that my thinking about impermanence seemed to have a big element of resignation. She challenged me to think bigger about my practice and offered me this question. Where is your Dharma zeal? Dharma zeal? What's that? I asked myself. So as I was preparing this talk, I realized that after some of this emptying of selfing and expectations and habits, that maybe what is called for is upping our commitment to practice, finding our Dharma seal. As I was exploring, well, what is Dharma zeal? It led me to ask the question, why am I on this path? Why do I devote so much of my time day after day to the Dhamma, to practice, to Seattle Insight, to study, to Sangha? The Buddha taught about suffering and the end of suffering. And what does it mean for me to aspire to the end of suffering? How do I actually live and practice with that aspiration as if it were real and here and now? Or as Narayan kept on saying, the here of the here and the now of the now. You know, where is my practice and my aspiration? Is it alive? You know, I came up with some ways that I'm going to explore, you know, maybe some sutta study, adding another sit or two with Sangha members every week, maybe additional ways of participating in Seattle Insight. But keep reflecting more deliberately on this question of what freedom from suffering means and looks like. What would it mean for you to increase your Dharma zeal? Why do you practice? Why are you on the path? Why are you here every Sunday morning? And thank you for being here. What is your greatest Dhamma aspiration? You know, the 10 pictures, as we've talked about them all year, aren't linear. We re-encounter them. They're not exactly a circle. I don't know what shape they are, but we can find ourselves in different places on this path. At picture 8, as we contemplate emptying of self-centeredness, emptying of preferences and habits and patterns, we may want to go back and revisit picture number 2, catching a glimpse. The first time we were here, there was just a hint that there is another dimension available to us beyond this material world. And now that we have struggled with great effort and found some semblance of quiet and ease, and we've spent some real quiet time, like the 7th picture in our hut, reflecting, we can return to see what else is there. What else can we get a glimpse of? What else is there to help us commit even more deeply and sincerely to practice, to being on the path? What kind of effort is being asked of us now at this point on the path? Maybe a softer kind of effort, not so rough and energized, not with any whip or rope. This is an effort of sincerity, of commitment and aspiration. I think it's an effort of the heart. So my retreat wasn't all about just building a garden of identity dukkha rocks and dealing with sleepiness. I also had several moments of, I guess of lack of a better word, I'd call transcendence. There I was, there was the stars and the trees, the bugs, the frogs, the yogis, the teachers, and it was so clear we're all made of the same elements, all part of life with a capital L. These were moments when that small self, the one that's filled with all these identities and expectations and habits, seemed to fade, and there was just life. Me, this living being, was part of that life, just part. As I reflected, those moments felt like moments of emptiness or fullness, just like Arv said a couple weeks ago when he was using words of infinity, awe, emptiness, and fullness. Martine Batchelor reminds us that we are a flow of inner and outer conditions. She says, only because of emptiness can things change and flow. Emptiness is not a vacuum, a black hole, but the possibility of endless transformations. Emptiness is not a vacuum, a black hole, but the possibility of endless transformations. There's no more grasping or self-created barriers and limitations. The Buddha nature can shine through and express itself fully. This is kind of big stuff that we're dealing with, these big concepts both in this month and ahead of us. Emptiness, the unconditioned, integration, awakening, nirvana. How best to engage with them? I think we need to bring to our practice the greatest amount of zeal that we can find. Bring all of our enthusiasm, interest, faith, and sincerity to being on this path. We need to remember to take refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha. Take refuge in our practice, in our decision to walk this path. Utejaniya, Burmese teacher, says, to take refuge in Dhamma is to take refuge in our very nature, this transitory existence in a human form. This is our reality and the vehicle by which we can open and awaken to ourselves. I'll read that again. To take refuge in Dhamma is to take refuge in our very nature, this transitory existence in a human form. This is our reality and the vehicle by which we can open and awaken to ourselves. Thank you for your attention. Let's just spend a couple moments in quiet and let those words settle. I'm going to create some breakout groups for us to talk with each other. And I know that for some of you, it's not the most attractive part of Sunday morning. But I'd really like to encourage you that a wonderful way of deepening our practice is by sharing it in a safe environment with our spiritual friends, our Kalyanamita. So I really encourage you to stay if you're just want to listen. That's totally okay. In these breakout groups, we bring our best listening selves. We don't offer advice or criticism. We listen wholeheartedly and then share our own experience, our own understanding, and our own questions, confusion, whatever. So I will invite you. I'm going to work on the breakout groups. And perhaps you want to share how the idea of emptying has settled on you, or perhaps the idea of how would you bring more zeal to your practice? Where's your Dharma zeal? So I'm going to let folks leave, and thank you all for being here, and hope to see you again. Okay, so I'm opening the rooms. Enjoy your sharing with each other. Welcome back, everybody. I think everyone's back. Good. Well, we have about 10 minutes before I turn it back to Jerry for announcements and closing. And I would love to hear how any of this landed on you, either emptying or Dharma zeal or anything. Anything anyone would like to share would be lovely. And I think you can just unmute. And if you go to reactions on the bottom of your screen and hit that, you'll find a little hand that you can raise. And then I can see who wants to say something. Kathy, are you, I see that you're unmuted. Did you want to share?
No? I had one comment about the concept of emptying, and in my small group, I referred back to my small group from 2 weeks ago, where when we looked at that picture, we all kind of had this, boy, that's a big expectation, because it seemed like the picture was about wholeness and not just the empty, but being whole. And I loved your concept of emptying, because that seems so much more obtainable. I can work on emptying, and I know how to do that.
Yeah.
But working on like that being whole seems like a lot harder. It's not as clear.
Yeah.
What to do.
You totally described my process. I found it very difficult as well. And I love too how Martine Batchelor talked about reducing from like 90% self-centeredness to only down to 15.
Mm-hmm.
And that reminds us that this is a path and a practice and a process.
Yeah.
And just like there are days when our sit is like, you know, we really find that collectedness of mind, and mindfulness is like right there and awareness. And then there are other days that the chatter just never seems to stop, you know, and this process and what we learn from those different experiences. And yeah, so thanks for sharing that, Kathy. Yeah, I'm glad it feels more accessible. It did for me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah, I agree. Accessible. That was a key word.
Mm-hmm.
Something that, you know, I got to get to something that's accessible.
Yeah.
Real, real significant difference.
It's having listened to different visiting teachers in SIMS for so many years, I really appreciate those teachers that, and we've had so many of them, that have helped to make the practice really accessible. It's like Christina Feldman, who many years ago reminded us that Pali is a language mostly of verbs. And so the way she talks about anatta, of not self, is the verb selfing. And so that really helped me too. Sean and Bruce, you have your hand up. Oh, can't hear you.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. I don't know. I guess maybe I'm not talking as loud as I usually do. That's probably a good thing. You know, one of the things about this particular picture, it hasn't come up yet in our discussions, but it really struck me as in the verse, and I can't remember the exact wording, but where there's reference to the ancestors. Could you read that, Suze?
The verse, whip, rope, person, and bull, all merge in no thing. This heaven is so vast, no message can stain it. How may a snowflake exist in a raging fire? Here are the footprints of the ancestors.
Yeah, that part. So the emptying, sometimes challenging, depending on what we're emptying. And this has come up for me, especially since Narayan's retreat, is to ask for the help of the ancestors, which are all those that have gone before me and all the practitioners that have gone before me all the way back to the time of the Buddha, have all been emptying in this process. And it's a lineage, and I'm a part of that lineage, and that lineage can hold me in the hard times, you know, the difficult things that are to let, that we let go of, like our life. Life.
Yeah. Thank you for that reminder. You know, recently one of the teachers I sat with was reminding us that the Buddha's mind went through the same thing that our minds go through. You know, the chatter, the holding on to, oh, this feels good, let me get more of it. This feels not so good, let me push it away. You know, there's not like, oh, they did this and our life is different because we're in 21st century Western civilization. And I think it's really helpful to remember that continuity within the lineage as well. Thanks, John and Bruce. Anyone else want to share anything? Yeah, Lauren, please.
Well, I was wondering about the footprints of the ancestors myself. And when I read it this morning, after I did listen to a talk by Martine Batchelor, because Suze told me about looking at emptiness as emptying, and I was very fascinated by that. And she said something, well, Suze mentioned it, the flow. It opens us to the flow, and it opens us to connection. If we empty, we empty ourselves of clinging to solid, separate identities, practices, I'm me, you're you, and we open to everything. And so to me, when I looked at that after I heard her talk, I thought, well, yeah, we're connected to the ancestors. We are all, you know, we're just part of that flow. That's what I thought. So I just wanted to share that.
Thank you.
I was puzzled by that myself.
Yeah, that flow over time and beyond time, and that flow of inner and outer conditions. And, you know, I think we've told you all that all of us LDLs get together every month to talk about, well, what do we understand for next month? And next month is a lot about integration. It's about that outer and inner and all of what we've been doing. And then what do we do? How do we go from with our practice and our lives and bring them into a congruity and an integration? Well, I very much appreciate you all being here and your attention, and I will turn it over to Jerry for announcements and closing.
Okay. Well, thank you, Sue. And thank you, everybody. It's just a real rich morning. I appreciate this. It's this area, as I've mentioned before, can be pretty elusive to me, you know, just looking on the face of it. And it's nice to have the, you know, a light being shined on it, and came from different people today. So I want to talk about a couple of things. First of all, I want to talk about Donna. You know, this is a mutual sharing. So I, you know, certainly would like to invite folks to consider how they might be able to support this Sim Sangha. And there's certainly a way to do it financially, and there's online, you can do it that way. But I'll also invite ways of participating, you know, look for volunteer ways. And I know that there are people, you know, looking for, as we go increasingly, we go live and have opportunities to sit together. There's going to be opportunities for greeters and other people to participate. So look to see whether you might want to offer, you know, that type of Donna.
It's really nice seeing everybody.
Thank you so much.